I kind of have to preface this introduction by telling you one Saturday afternoon, my wife and I were driving around, and for some strange reason, she was driving. I was in the passenger seat, and I heard Dr. Walker come on the radio on NPR, and my wife likes music. I like to be talked to, and she reached, and I went, no, do not change channels. This man mesmerized me for an hour listening to the things that were of concern to him as regards patient safety and medical mistakes. And I thought, boy, this guy can bring a lot to our association. So welcome, everyone, to the 95th edition of our annual meeting. And it's with a great deal of pleasure that I introduce Dr. Robert M. Walker as our keynote speaker today. This is the man that formed the hospitalist concept. And it's something to which I think all of us are accommodating fairly quickly. In addition to his medical practice in internal medicine, he has written books and conducted website adventures as far as patient safety is concerned. And his efforts have been recognized in 2004 when he received the John M. Eisenberg Award. It's the nation's top honor in patient safety and quality. And then again in 2012, he was named the 14th most influential physician executive in the United States by Modern Healthcare Magazine. So he's got some gravitas as he comes to speak to us. What impressed me is he was the current, or just finished a term as the current chair of the American Board of Internal Medicine. And in my book, that speaks volumes. So this afternoon, he's going to be talking to us about what we need to know, and you can read it as well as I do, to get rid of medical mistakes. And I'm going to get off the stage and let him entertain us at this point. Dr. Walker.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Pavelka. Thank you all for being here. I'm trying to mesmerize you for an hour after lunch. It's tricky, but I'll do the best I can. I think the topic is worthy of our attention, and hopefully you'll find it interesting and important and relevant to your practice. What I'm going to do is talk about what we need to know to fix the problem of medical mistakes. We've been working on this now for, I'd say, about 15 years, and I think we've made some progress, and I think we've come to better understand the nature of the problem and some of the things that we need to do to try to fix it. And so let me start off with an observation. And one observation I have made is that in order to make progress in patient safety, we need to bring together a number of disciplines that typically have not talked to each other very well. Whether that's doctors or dentists talking to nurses effectively, or to pharmacists effectively, or to healthcare administrators effectively, it's all of that, but it's more than that. It is what can we learn and what can't we learn from the example of aviation. That's often brought up, how staggeringly safe aviation is and how dangerous what we do is. So what actually are the lessons from fields like aviation or nuclear power or cognitive psychology? And I have to say, this has become an interesting, it's one of the reasons the topic to me is so fascinating, because you really do have to learn things that you did not learn during your training about the way other industries and other people think about errors in their world. So I want to start off with an observation about trying to learn to speak different languages. A couple of years ago, I had the privilege of spending the year in the United Kingdom as a Fulbright scholar. And I ventured off to Wales. And in Wales, they all speak English, of course, but they are trying desperately to hold on to their ancient language of Welsh. And it's dying pretty quickly because nobody speaks Welsh. And so one of the things that they're trying to do to hold on to Welsh is there's a rule that when you put up a street sign, you have to put up the English and the Welsh translation. I just met a couple of your colleagues from Canada, and of course it feels a little bit like Quebec, which has a little bit of the same dynamic with English and French. Now, of course, I think you recognize the conundrum here. Not many people speak Welsh anymore, and yet you've got to put it up in the street sign. There's a problem. And so what the Welsh government has done quite helpfully is create essentially an office of Welsh translation. And when you're putting up a street sign, you can call that office and leave a message, and they will call you back or send you back an email with the Welsh translation. It's very helpful. And so here's a sign that went up in Welsh in Wales a couple of years ago. No entry for heavy goods vehicles, residential site only. Straightforward enough. They called the 1-800 Welsh number. They left a message. They got a message back a few minutes later. It's a very, very neat and very efficient service. And here it is. I don't know how many of you speak Welsh, but there it is. It was only a little bit later that they realized that what this translates to is, I'm not in the office at the moment. Please send any work to be translated. So it can feel like this on some days in my world and probably yours as we try to learn the lessons from other fields, other disciplines, in an effort to make care safer. What I'm going to talk to you about is the patient safety field. And it's an interesting observation to even talk about the field of patient safety, because obviously none of us have wanted to harm our patients, and all of us felt terribly when we have done that over our careers. And yet my feeling is that this began as a field, as a concerted discipline, and as an effort really only 14 years ago with the publication of this report by the Institute of Medicine in December of 1999. Its formal name is To Err is Human, Building a Safer Health System. And it's a, sort of an interesting phenomenon. How does a single Institute of Medicine report galvanize what has become an international movement? That's not an easy thing to do. And the way this one did it, you may recall, was they took some data from a study that had been done at Harvard about a decade earlier, did a little fancy statistical manipulation, and came out with the estimate that between 44 and 98,000 patients in the United States die each year from medical mistakes. That would make it about the sixth or seventh leading cause of death. You may have seen in the press a couple of weeks ago a new paper that came out revising these estimates up to 200 to 400,000. It's hard to know which one is right. But in any case, it's a big and scary number, a number that was enough, large enough to get the attention of patients and the media and legislators. That said, if the IOM had left it there just with that number, I do believe it would have gotten some attention, but would not have launched what has become an international movement. In fact, I don't recall ever hearing the words patient safety until this report came out. What really worked, and there's a lesson here about how you get people's attention, what really worked was the most impressive bit of spin I have seen in my career in healthcare. You may recall this. The IOM took those numbers, which are a little bit bloodless, did the math, and said this would be the equivalent of a large plane crashing every day. And if you do the math, that's right. It's 200 or 300 deaths per day of medical mistakes. That was the metaphor that launched the patient safety field. People have criticized it as being a little hyperbolic, a little over the top. I actually think it's marvelous. And it's marvelous for a couple of reasons. One is I think there are some lessons from aviation that have been useful, although many don't translate well. A second is, as we think about what we're all doing to try to keep healthcare safer, and I'll talk about some of the lessons as I go through this, and we're saying, oh my God, that's a lot to do. I don't have the time for this. I don't have the energy for this. Another requirement, another regulation, another accreditation standard. Just think for a moment about what we would do in this country if, in fact, a plane was crashing every day. Let's say just 2 days in a row. And the answer would be we would close down the system. We would not allow another plane to take off until we had, to our satisfaction, fixed that problem. And yet we continue to do our business every day. The other reason I like the analogy is maybe raise your hand if you would fly electively, if you didn't have to fly, if you knew a plane would crash somewhere in the country that day. How many of you are that gutsy? A couple, the ones who raised your hands, how about if it was 5 o'clock in the afternoon and one hadn't crashed yet? Right, you would think about it quite carefully. I'm going to fly tonight at about 6, and if I knew a plane was going to crash somewhere in the country and none had gone down yet, I would cancel that flight. And yet you have patients checking into your practice every day of the year or checking into the hospital to see you every day of the year with about the same risk, a risk that I don't think any of us would take if it was to do something like flying an airplane. So This metaphor, I think, was useful, really did get people's attention, and has launched a field. And what I'm here to talk to you about is some of the things we've learned over the past decade or so. Now, probably the biggest lesson, and the one I'll emphasize, is the notion of what we call a systems approach. The idea that we know that most errors in every industry, but we're talking now about healthcare, most errors are committed by good, competent, caring people who are trying to do the right thing. And the error really is evidence that they're human. And that's all it's evidence of. And so trying to approach this problem the way we did before December 99, which is to say, let's get people to be more careful, to try a little harder not to screw up, is stupid. It simply doesn't work, admonishing people to be anything but what they are, which is human beings, fallible human beings. And so we have embraced the notion in this field of what's called a systems approach, essentially assuming that humans will blow it from time to time and building a system around them that anticipates their errors, catches them before they cause terrible harm. And you're familiar with pieces of this that you probably didn't do 10 or 12 or 15 years ago, whether it's counting teeth to be sure you're taking out the right one or signing a surgical site or various other things that you now do into your practice that you probably didn't do 15 years ago before we started thinking about this in a system way. Why did we need a system approach, and why might this not have resonated so strongly 40, 30, 40, or 50 years ago? Well, does anybody know who the guy is in this picture? All right, yes? Good. Marcus Welby. The reason I ask you that is I showed this slide to the medical students at my institution, UCSF, several months ago, and none of them could answer that question. And then I said, come on, folks, that's Marcus Welby, and they all said, who's that? It is, like, scary how young these people are. So they know everything about Dr. McDreamy and House and all that. They just had never heard of Marcus Welby, which is a little weird. This is what it looked like to be a doctor, and I imagine the same would be true for an oral surgeon or a dentist. 30 or 40 years ago, the pace wasn't that fast. You saw people in the office, in the hospital. You took care of patients in the ICU. You did the surgery. You delivered the babies. You did everything. And you probably could get away with that because life was not all that complex. This is what life looks like in the intensive care unit in my hospital. And just to kind of show you around, if this is not a place you work in very often, this is renal replacement therapy. We now have figured out how to bring dialysis to the patient's bedside. Very cool, very complicated. This is not at all unusual. The sea of IV bags, there are, I think, 11 or 12 there, going through two or three different pumps, most of which, if given incorrectly, could kill the patient quite quickly. Over this patient's shoulder here is a very sophisticated mechanical ventilator. Again, very cool, amazing technology, but risky if you don't get it right. I have no idea what that is, but I'm sure it's very important. And hiding underneath all this technology, you might have not noticed, but it's a patient. And I think this snuck up on us. It certainly did to me in my practice. If your system of keeping patients safe, whether it's in this setting or in your OR or in your office, if your system is I'm going to be really, really careful and be really well-trained and work really hard, I hope you've come to recognize that that is a cruel joke. There is no way that any of us can keep people safe if our system of safety hinges upon human perfection. So that is really the kind of uber lesson that I'm here to share with you, and now I'll try to get a little bit more in the weeds about what does that mean? How does that translate to thinking about the problems in our day-to-day life in a systems kind of approach? So to do that, I'm going to share a case with you. I found over the years in talking about this that it's easy to get a little theoretical and a little high up in the clouds, and it's a little realer if you talk about a case. This is not a case from your world, but I hope that, and I think that most of the lessons will be relevant to what you do. This is a case that took place about 10 years ago, but still highly relevant, at least in what I see in my work. It's a case that involves a discipline in cardiology called electrophysiology. This is the study and treatment of arrhythmias. So we call it EPS, the electrophysiology service. There's a quote from a chess master, the mistakes are there, all there waiting to be made, which I think is the nature of the beast here. And let me tell you a little bit about what happened. There were two patients, this turned out to be in my hospital, which, by the way, U.S. News and World Reports calls the seventh best hospital in the United States. I have no idea if it is. The methodology for that is ridiculous, but we put it on every billboard in San Francisco the minute it comes out. This took place in my hospital. We had two patients whose names were similar but not the same. I've changed the names for HIPAA purposes, but just so you get a feel, let's call one Jane Morrison and the other Joan Morris. The idea, similar last names, not exactly the same. Both were women in their mid-60s, both spoke English perfectly well, both were high school graduates, both were hospitalized at the same time. One of them, Jane Morrison, was a woman who had come into our hospital to have a cerebral aneurysm embolized. She'd been having headaches, she got a CAT scan, it showed two fairly plump intracerebral aneurysms, both large enough to be at risk of rupturing. She came into my hospital, we embolized one of them. The notion is you're not supposed to do both at the same time. Embolized one of them to be sure she didn't have a complication. The plan was, and she knew this, that we were going to bring her back a few weeks later to do the second one. She was admitted on a Monday, I believe. The embolization took place on a Tuesday, by all accounts successful. The plan was that she'd stay overnight, sleep, be seen the next morning, be sure she had no neurological deficits. If so, she would be sent home. On the same floor was Joan Morris. Joan Morris was a woman who had had multiple cardiac arrhythmias, had had a couple episodes of syncope and passing out, and she was admitted to the hospital for a cardiac electrophysiology procedure, this procedure where we thread catheters into your heart to document your rhythm and map any arrhythmias with an effort then either to find drugs that work or fry if we find a twitchy part of the myocardium. She was supposed to have her electrophysiology procedure on a Tuesday. She got bumped because of an emergency, so she was guaranteed that she'd be the first case of the day on Wednesday. She was asleep Wednesday morning. So both of these women, Joan Morris, Jane Morrison, asleep on the same floor, one waiting to go home after a brain procedure, the other waiting to have her cardiac procedure. The charge nurse comes into the electrophysiology laboratory first thing in the morning at 6 o'clock in the morning, looks at the list. The list, by the way, is this haphazard pastiche of people sending in emails with names of patients to put on the list. There were constantly typos. It wasn't linked to the hospital's computer system in any meaningful way. We, of course, only learned all of this later after we analyzed this. She sees the first patient of the day is Jane Morrison. She calls up to the floor, gets the charge nurse, and says, "We're ready for the patient Morrison. Please send her down to electrophysiology. She's first case of the day." The charge nurse, the ward clerk. The ward clerk is extraordinarily busy, sitting on a sort of swivel chair with people throwing charts at her, now it'd be computers, talking to her on the phone. Here's Morrison, looks up at the whiteboard where all the patients are listed and sees the name Morris. And her brain locks in on that like a laser. That's what she thought she heard in the din, a mistake that we all make in our lives all the time. That's the name she thought she heard. She says to the electrophysiology nurse, "Okay, I'll tell Miss Morris's nurse that you're ready for her and she'll send her down." She pages Miss Morris's nurse and says, "They're calling for your patient down in cardiology and electrophysiology. She's ready to go down now. She's first case of the day." Miss Morris's nurse says to herself, "That's kind of funny. I thought my patient's being discharged today after her brain procedure." But then she has another thought. And every nurse I've ever spoken to about this says, of course. Her next thought is, the doctor must have changed the order, or decided to order this test. Nobody told me, because nobody tells me a damn thing around here. This is what every nurse I've ever spoken to says, yes, of course, that's what happens all the time, whether it's in my office practice or in the hospital. So even though she'd never heard about this procedure, had no idea why her patient who was there for this brain procedure that she had yesterday might need this heart procedure, she says, okay, I'll go ahead and get the patient ready for her for heart procedure. She walks into the patient's room, she wakes her up. She says, "Ms. Morris, they're calling for you for your procedure." Miss Morris, of course, thinks, huh, that's funny. I was told I wasn't going to have my procedure for a couple of weeks, thinking that she's referring to the second brain procedure. The nurse reassures her and says, you know, I know you thought that, but they're calling for you now. They must have a good reason to do that. Miss Morris, after objecting a couple of times, It's very hard to object too hard when you're a patient lying in a bed. Says, okay. The nurse says, when you get down there, I'm sure they'll explain this to you. So Ms. Morris climbs into the gurney. Her chart is there and is wheeled down to the electrophysiology laboratory where she's parked outside the lab before the test. The nurse comes to greet her, welcomes her, takes a look at the chart, looks for the informed consent, which is supposed to have been done the night before. It's not on the chart. She says, oh, that's weird, but God, they screw up all the time on the floor. They must have put it in the wrong file. She calls over to the cardiology fellow. She says, you got to get another informed consent for this lady. The other thing she does, by the way, is she does a safety check. It's not like we had no safety checks back then. She checks to be sure that the name on the patient's wristband matches the name on the chart. And in fact, it does, because she was her. She just happened not to be a person who needed a heart procedure, but the name on the wristband matched the name on the chart. They sent down the correct chart. So that safety check, of course, turned out to be false reassurance. The electrophysiology fellow came over to get informed consent from this patient. And you might say, how is he going to get informed consent from a patient who doesn't need this heart procedure? Well, this is the informed consent. You probably can't see it, but it sort of says, I've looked at this for a few years now, it sort of says EP study, and I think the next word is possible. Then it says ICD. I've not been able to make out the next word, even though I've looked at this for several years. And then possible PM, and I can't really make out the next word. She signed this. Of course, there's no way that a normal person would have any idea that what she's signing is a consent for an electrophysiology study, the possible implantation of an implantable cardiac defibrillator, and possible pacemaker placement. So what should have been another layer of protection, informed consent, was a kabuki dance, was really a joke. And I'm sure that the informed consent sort of mirrored this process, quite pro forma, just getting the paperwork done. She then goes for the cardiology fellow takes the patient after getting the informed consent into the room, gowns, drapes her. He's standing there with the nurse getting ready to do the procedure. Now, I actually have to go back a slide. I'm worried about screwing up. Can you do that? Perfect. Okay. So you might say, all right, now we're going to be golden. We're going to catch this in the nick of time, because the attending physician, the electrophysiologist, had actually met the correct patient the night before, spoke to her, got informed consent, and so he's going to come in, and of course, you know, we're going to abort this at the moment of truth. Dramatic, but no harm, no foul. Except in the name of efficiency, what he does is park himself, as in this picture, park himself behind his console to start the procedure, and he reviews the pictures on his computer console while the fellow and the nurse are by the patient's bedside. So unless he has x-ray vision or can see that the top inch of the patient's head is not the inch that he saw last night and the patient he got informed consent from, he doesn't realize he's about to start a procedure on the wrong patient. The procedure begins. About 20 minutes into the procedure, I can tell you, having spoken to these people, all of these clinicians are getting wildly frustrated, because it was supposed to be a pretty slam dunk procedure. This woman had bad arrhythmias. Shouldn't have been very hard to map them in the way they do this, but they're not finding anything wrong with this lady's heart. And so they think something's wrong with the equipment. They're turning up the voltage. They're repositioning the catheter. They're doing all the stuff that you might do if you sort of get a surprising finding when you're inside a patient, you've started a case. It's still not working, but they're getting pretty stressed out. At that moment, the neurologist who's supposed to discharge this patient goes into her room on the floor. Her room is empty. He goes out to the ward clerk, says, where's my patient? They say, oh, we sent her down to cardiology for her electrophysiology study 45 minutes ago. He says, what are you talking about? She doesn't need that. She says, I don't know. They called for her. We sent her down. He goes galloping two stairs at a time up into electrophysiology, barges through the door, sort of like, you know, a bar in an old movie, barges in just at the time that the team is getting particularly stressed and antsy about how difficult this procedure is proving to be. He says something like, what are you people doing on my patient? And they say, and he's a relatively young junior trainee, the attending physician says something to the equivalent of, chill out, son. We're really busy here, and it's a pretty dicey part of the procedure. We'll talk to you when we're done. That is just enough of a rebuff for him to go back on his heels, say to himself, I guess my attending must have ordered this. I wonder why. He vows to ask his supervising physician later why this patient needed this heart procedure. He goes back to the rest of his work. Finally, the attending of this woman goes in to say goodbye to her on the floor. The room is empty. Where's my patient? She's getting a heart procedure. What are you talking about? Calls down there, demands to speak to the attending, demands that the attending read off the patient's name. And like a thunderbolt, they both realize simultaneously they have committed a breathtaking error. Who's at fault? The EP nurse who failed to use the patient's full ID when she called the ward. She said, send down Morrison. No first name, no hospital number, no birthday. The ward nurse who, despite her reservations, released her patient. The attending who failed to reintroduce himself to the patient in the name of efficiency. The resident who had allowed his concerns to be allayed without checking. Or maybe you have your own favorite culprit. It was from a case like this. This was one of my first introductions to the field and many others over the years, that this notion, which up until that point had seemed theoretical to me, this idea that it's mostly about systems and not about bad people, became quite real. I have, in the process of writing up this case for publication, we had the chance to interview all of these people, the nurse, the doctor, the doctors, and the patient. By the way, the patient did not sue. The patient wanted an apology, and she got about 90 of them. And she wanted some reassurance that we would do everything we could to be sure this didn't happen again, and I think we did. And by the way, she told me that I'm glad my heart checked out okay. So we wrote this up several years ago in an article in the Annals of Internal Medicine. We called it The Wrong Patient. And the discussants, one of whom is the president of the Joint Commission, now the major accreditor of American hospitals, I actually, believe it or not, shortened the case for you. He found 17 different errors, any one of which, if it had been caught, would have stopped this in its tracks. None of them were caught. And so what this brings up is the kind of the dominant mental model of the field of patient safety. It's known as the Swiss cheese model. And I hope some of you have heard of it. It really is, it is the basic science of patient safety in the same way the Krebs cycle is the basic science of biochemistry. This is the way we think about patient safety. It was articulated by a British psychologist named Jim Reason, who wasn't writing about healthcare. What Reason did was study nuclear power plant accidents. He studied Three Mile Island. He studied the Challenger disaster. He studied terrible accidents that happen in complicated organizations. And what he found was the same pattern over and over and over again, and he kind of operationalized it in this model. And what it basically says is that human beings screw up, and we live out here, often in glitches that are no jazzier than forgetting where you put your cell phone or where you parked your car. Right? We do this. It's part of our charm. But those little glitches don't cause terrible harm in complicated organizations because the organizations either purposefully or in kind of a random way build in layers of protection to block those harms from causing a disaster for the patient or the space shuttle, whatever the issue is. The problem is that each of these layers of protection has holes in it. That's why he called it the Swiss cheese model. And in most days, you know, we don't see these terrible errors. We operate on the wrong patient or those sort of things. We don't see them very often because, yes, there was a glitch, and it made it through layer one, but layer two caught it. Or it made it through one and two, and layer three caught it. When you see the terrible organizational accident, as Reason called it, it almost always looks like this. There were multiple layers of protection. They were all faulty. And that day also, there was bad karma. So what are the chances two people named Morris and Morrison will both be there on the same day for a procedure? It's that sort of thing. Turns out the chances aren't all that low. This happens a lot. What's so useful about this model is if you buy it, and I really do, what it does is it averts our attention from the intuitive. The intuitive is to say, who do I point fingers at? Who screwed up here, and do I fire them, sue them, shame them? Or, if it was me, how could I be so stupid and so careless? It gets us to take a breath before we instinctively say that and rather ask a different set of questions, which is, what are those protections like? What are the holes? Is there a way we can shrink the holes and create enough overlap in the layers that the human glitches will not cause terrible harm? When I parked about 19 miles away from here this morning, immediately I pulled out my iPhone and I wrote down in the iPhone where I had been parked. I know perfectly well that I will never find my car if I don't do that. That's just a layer of protection that I've built into my own practice because I know that I know how error-prone I am in just that simple example. So this is the nature of the field. When we do a root cause analysis of an error, this is the question that we're trying to answer. What were those protections like? Is there a way that we can shrink the holes? And is there a way that we can create enough overlap so that the holes will never align? That is the work of the field of patient safety, and what I hope you will already doing or begin to do more of in your own practice, because I think this is relevant to a two-person office practice as well as to a 500-bed hospital. In this case, let me take you through some of the layers of Swiss cheese, and then I'll put a little bit more meat on the bones in a second. Staggeringly weak identification protocols. The idea that we could call for a patient for invasive procedure and use only the patient's last name is unbelievable. Think about, you know, how you need to identify yourself when you're calling your bank for a transaction or calling Amazon for a transaction. And yet this was standard practice at a very good hospital not all that long ago. Clunky IT systems, not a major player in this case, although you could imagine a system where the IT system spoke in the electrophysiology laboratory, spoke to the hospital's IT system, made sure it was the same patient. There was barcoding on the patient's wrist to be sure it was the same patient. All of it was sort of wrapped around in an integrated whole. We certainly didn't have that at the time. And although we have a better system now, I'll tell you in a second about an error that I recently saw that told me that IT is capable of creating new kinds of errors, in many ways more breathtaking than ones that we used to see. Failure to appreciate what's called a complex adaptive system. I'll tell you what I mean by that in a second. The culture of low expectations. Again, I'll tell you a little bit more about that in a second. And there's something about the culture of relationships. Why is it? How can it be that the nurse, when being told her patient is going for this procedure, the resident, when being told to chill out, that they're busy, did not persist with their concerns? They laid off. And there's something about what are called authority gradients, relationships that different people in healthcare have with each other that turn out to be central here. That's why we performed an invasive cardiac procedure on the wrong patient. You know, yes, each of these people screwed up. Each of these people felt badly about that, I can tell you. But if all we had done was point fingers at them and shame them or fire them, we would have done exactly this, probably not within the next month or two because it's so fresh on people's mind, but eventually the same situation would have repeated itself. The key here is to focus more on the system than on the people. Let me take you through a few examples of this to make it a little bit realer. Here, my kids in a Chinese restaurant. There's something now that we do in hospitals. I don't know if you do it in your office, but I recommend that you think about this. It's something called a readback. It's now a requirement in the hospital by the Joint Commission that when, for example, the laboratory or pathology calls the floor with an important piece of information, what's supposed to happen is the other person on the other end of the phone is supposed to write it down and then read it back to the caller to be sure that they got it right. We started doing that in my hospital about 7 years ago when the Joint Commission made it a requirement. So there are some people who think, okay, the Joint Commission invented readbacks. Actually, I believe my favorite little Chinese takeout restaurant in San Francisco invented readbacks because they've been doing that for 30 years. When I call them up and I say, I want your hot and sour soup and your special eggplant, they always say, let me read your order back to you before they hang up the phone. They've been doing that forever. Now, let me cue you in on a secret. There is no Chinese takeout restaurant joint commission. There's nobody that made them do that. Why do they do that? And my hospital, $2 billion hospital does not do that because their business case to get my order right is actually more powerful than our business case to get our data correct. That's a little scary and a little concerning, but they know if I order the hot and sour and I open up the brown paper bag and I have the wonton, I'm pissed, and they may have lost a customer. There are plenty of other good Chinese takeout restaurants just down the street. So their business case to get it right is actually more powerful than ours is. A little bit shameful that we needed our accreditor to tell us you should do this when it's a really pretty straightforward system fix. Now, an example of other ways of fixing systems and not depending on human perfection, the perfection of human either memory or performance, is seen in what we've done with checklists. And I know that some of you have begun integrating checklists into your practice. I would say this is the main success story that we've seen in the patient safety field. This is the story of central line associated bloodstream infections, known as CLABSIs, and the use of a pretty simple five-item checklist, started really at Johns Hopkins, then tried in more than 100 intensive care units at hospitals in the state of Michigan, and then ultimately rolled out to the entire United States with a massive decrease, more than about 70 or 80% decrease in the frequency of this pretty deadly infection that we used to consider just bad things happen to good people. These people are in the intensive care unit. They have big lines. Of course, they're going to get infected. We now know that you can prevent virtually all of these infections if you use a checklist to ensure that everybody does these five things correctly all the time. When I tell lay friends of mine that our great epiphany in the safety field was we discovered the value of checklists, they look at me like I'm crazy, but that actually is one of the major advances. Obviously, checklists were discovered in many other industries a long time ago. Now, one thing, though, I want to caution you about is that there is sort of a little magical thinking about checklists, you know, treating checklists like penicillin, like it's a magic bullet, you just give it to people, it cures the system. This is an article written by a sociologist, Charles Bosk, along with Peter Pronovost, who's famously was the critical care physician at Hopkins, who really made the whole checklist thing prominent throughout the world now. They wrote, "The mistake of the simple checklist story is in the assumption that a technical solution, checklists, can solve an adaptive or sociocultural problem. To improve safety, healthcare needs to get the technical and adaptive work right. Without attention to the adaptive work, checklists would probably suffer the same fate as guidelines, often left unused even when they're very robust. Although we all hope for the simple solution that with ease and no additional expense makes a stay in the ICU safer, there's some danger in this in mistaking hope for reality. The answer to the question of what a simple checklist can achieve is, on its own, not much." And I think Peter Pronovost will be the first person to say this. The checklist is very important, but what worked in the CLABSI story was not just checklists. It was culture change. It was teamwork training. It was comparative data. The heads of each of the hospitals in Michigan were given data on not only their use of the checklist, but on their central line associated infection rates. It was comparative data with their colleagues, so it engendered good-natured and maybe not so good-natured competition, a little shame. It was all of that that led to this amazing success story, not just the importation of a simple tool like a checklist. I think there's an important lesson there. And the lesson really is this notion that healthcare is a complex adaptive system. It is not straightforward. Simple solutions tend not to work very well. The business writer Brenda Zimmerman writes about complex adaptive systems. System and external environment are constantly changing. Uncertainty and paradox are inherent. Problems can't be solved in machine-like fashion. You can sometimes move them forward that way, but you have to get the people involved to understand the culture. Individuals are independent but highly interdependent, creative decision makers. Solutions often emerge from minimal specifications and simple rules. Over-specification gets in the way. If any of you have read Atul Gawande's book, The Checklist Manifesto, which is a terrific book, and one of the points that Atul makes there is when they started designing the surgical checklist, they had about 1,000 items on it because they wanted to specify everything, and they realized that A, nobody would ever do it, and B, it would actually get in the way of some flexibility that teams need to have. So it specifies a few basic things to start the team on the right path. One of the things that they have found to be most helpful seems like almost silly in its simplicity, which is everybody introducing themselves to each other, which automatically elevates people on the team to a position where they are much more comfortable speaking up if they think something is wrong, as opposed to their baseline posture, which is I can't possibly speak up to the doctor or to the surgeon, you know, because he or she must know what's going on, even when I see something that seems glitchy to me. So I think this is a very useful kind of insight that we've gotten in the last 10 years that we certainly didn't have before. Just to point out that checklists are only one of many evidence-based approaches to safety, I won't take time going through this. It is to say that there's not one solution that ever works, that always works, and I'm seeing a little bit of danger in the safety field that checklists is the solution to everything. If we just had a checklist, it would solve everything. It simply doesn't work that way. It's not that simple. It's worth having in your toolkit a robust set of different kinds of fixes. because sometimes checklists will be right, sometimes reminders, sometimes readbacks. Sometimes the answer will be in analyzing your cases of errors and learning the lessons from them in a process known as a root cause analysis. Let me spend a minute on healthcare information technology. This, to me, is a fascinating area and one in which I think we're all being surprised by how complicated it is. It's probably getting better. We just, in my hospital, implemented the top-selling computer hospital computer system after having tried another one and at the cost of about $150 million, realizing it wasn't very good and pulling the plug on it and switching to the best-selling system, which is known in the field as the cream of the crap. Still not very good, although the best of the lot. It feels, though, like it's getting worse. And the reason it feels to me like it's getting worse is IT is so unbelievably good in the rest of my life. When I make a reservation on OpenTable or go to MapQuest or all the extraordinary things, go to United Airlines website and get my boarding pass on my phone, it is so slick and so flawless in the rest of our lives and so clunky still in our professional lives that even though it's getting better, I think it's getting better slower than what we're seeing in the rest of our lives. The early glowing studies about how easy and slick IT was came from two or three hospitals that have been doing this for 30 years and are quite atypical. It's not what the rest of us have seen. We're seeing a growing literature on IT-related safety hazards. My favorite one is one I saw recently. A child came into a hospital on one double-strength Ceftra prophylaxis a day. The kid had an immunodeficiency and ended up being given 40 Ceftra tablets. It turns out not to be good for you. It turns out to cause seizures when you get 40 Ceftra tablets. How do you end up with 40 Ceftra tablets? Well, the intern, there was a rule in this particular hospital that for any kid under 40 kilograms, you can't just order a dose. The dose has to be weight-based. So the intern ordered 5 milligrams per kilogram of trimethoprim, which is correct. Computer did its calculation. So that's 193 milligrams of trimethoprim. There's no pill that size. That rounds off to one double-strength Ceftra, which, by the way, was what the kid was on. The order went to the pharmacist. The pharmacist saw it and called the intern back and said, the right dose is 160. Go back to computerized entry and go ahead and enter that. The intern went back and put in 160 in the little box, of course, not recognizing the computer had defaulted to milligrams per kilogram. So now, rather than ordering 160 milligrams of trimethoprim, the doctor was ordering 160 milligrams per kilogram of trimethoprim for this kid's size. That was 39 Ceftra pills. That's not where the story gets interesting. Where the story gets interesting is the intern, of course, got a Are You Sure text box because this was a massive overdose. The intern in her first week at this hospital was getting alerts on virtually every patient that she saw in pediatrics. She called her resident and said, what do I do with this? The resident said, ignore all the alerts, otherwise you can't get your work done. She ignored the alert. The pharmacist, with about the same issue, ignored the alert. The multi-million dollar robot at this hospital that pulls the medicines out of the pharmacy, an award-winning bit of technology, dutifully followed instructions like a good robot and pulled out 39 Ceftra tablets, shrink-wrapped them, barcoded each one of them, sent them up to the floor. The nurse got a drawer full of 39 Ceftra tablets with a note on her electronic system saying that's what the kids should get. She actually barcoded number one. The barcode machine said, that's not enough. You need to give 38 more tablets. The nurse thought of asking her charge nurse about this because it seemed weird. The charge nurse was busy giving another kid chemotherapy. The nurse said, I don't want to interrupt her. That's unsafe. She went into the child's room, 16-year-old kid. She was barcoding these like the supermarket checker. After about 10 or 12 tablets, she turned to this kid. The kid was in the hospital for a colonoscopy. She'd been told that she was going to have to get a whole lot of pills for the preparation. The nurse said to the kid, this seems like an awful lot of medicine. The kid said, yeah, they told me before I came in I was going to have to take a lot of medicines. The nurse said, okay, it must be right. She gave the kid 39 Ceftra tablets. That's what computers can do for you if you're not careful. These are all very good doctors and nurses. This is a new kind of error that I think we're going to see more of. That said, I'm not a Luddite, neither should you be. Obviously, computers are necessary, and I think they ultimately are making care safer, although these hazards are real. Final couple points, the culture of low expectations. I told you in the article about the case I told you about, this came up. This is what the authors wrote. We suspect that these physicians and nurses had become accustomed to poor communication and teamwork. A culture of low expectations developed in which participants came to expect a norm of faulty and incomplete exchange of information, which led them to conclude that these red flags, just think about the number of red flags in the EP case. You know, that's funny. I didn't know my patient was getting this heart procedure. You know, that's weird. Or in the case I just told you about, that's 39 Septra? You know, what's that about? And yet in each case, people allow themselves to say the four most dangerous words in healthcare: it must be right. It allowed them to conclude that these red flags signified not unusual worrisome harbingers, but rather mundane repetition of the poor communication to which they'd become inured. I can't tell you the number of errors that I've seen and analyzed over the years whose fundamental underlying root cause there were people involved, sometimes the doctor, sometimes the nurse, sometimes the clerk, sometimes the family member, who said, that's weird, that's surprising, I've never seen anything quite like that, but who then said to themselves, it must be right, either because they didn't feel like they had time to check, or if they did check, someone would be angry at them for questioning their authority. All of that happens. If you want to create a safer culture in your world, make sure you never hear yourself saying, or none of your staff ever say the words, it must be right. In safe industries, on nuclear power plants, on aircraft carriers, no one ever says it must be right. If they're not sure it's right, they do what it takes to be sure that it's right. Final bit I want to talk about is another piece on culture. You probably know this story. This is from Tenerife in the Canary Islands. This is the crash of the two 747s into each other now nearly 40 years ago. The story really was a KLM 747 was at the end of a runway getting ready to take off on a foggy morning in Tenerife. And it was a single runway, so the other planes that were out on the runway had to go off into these little side shunts in order to clear the runway for a takeoff. Before the fog had set in, the pilot, co-pilot, and flight engineer in the KLM cockpit saw a Pan Am 747 toward the end of the runway, but it was moving toward one of those side spurs. And it was perfectly logical for them to conclude that it must be out of the way. But unfortunately, before it moved into the side spur, the fog came in so they could no longer see the end of the runway. A transmission came in from air traffic control, and because as the pilot in the Pan Am plane, excuse me, in the KLM plane, asked for permission to take off. A transmission came to them, and this is from the later report. On hearing this transmission, the KLM flight engineer asked, is he not clear then? Meaning, is that Pan Am 747 not out of the way? He heard enough of the transmission to recognize that something about the Pan Am was in the transmission, but the rest of it got a little bit garbled. The KLM captain, who was a legendary captain in KLM's fleet, it was in charge of safety for all of KLM 747s, the KLM captain didn't understand, and the engineer repeated the question, is he not clear that Pan American? Couldn't be any clearer that he had a concern that the runway wasn't open. But the captain replied with an emphatic yes, and I've had the italics here, perhaps influenced by his great prestige, making it difficult to imagine an error on the part of such an experienced pilot, expert pilot. Both the co-pilot and the flight engineer made no further objections. To the best of our ability to recreate what happened in the cockpit on that terrible day in Tenerife, the captain was emphatically sure that the runway was clear. The people in the cockpit with the captain were not. And yet back in the culture of aviation in 1977, you did not question the judgment of the leader. And so, of course, you know what happened. The captain pulled the throttle, picked up steam, emerged from the fog to see the horrifying sight of the Pan Am at the end of the runway, actually managed to get his nose above the Pan Am plane, climbed steeply enough to do that, but in doing so, his tail dragged along the ground of the runway, sending sparks a couple hundred feet in the air, was able to get his tail about 30 feet into the air, just high enough to shear off the upper deck of the Pan Am 747. Both planes exploded, and 583 people died. Still the worst air traffic collision or accident of all time. It was from this that aviation learned the price of having that steep a hierarchy, that people could be in this cockpit and not feel comfortable questioning the leader. This notion that in a bad error, there often is someone who said, this is funny, this smells weird, and yet did not feel comfortable speaking up to power. Aviation has done a lot to change that culture, and part of the reason it is so staggeringly safe, the Asiana crash in my airport several months ago, which was tragic, there were three people died from that crash, was the first fatality in a U.S. aviation crash in more than 5 years. This is a study that Brian Sexton, who studies safety culture, did now several years ago, but it's been repeated. The results are the same. He asked surgeons and other members of OR crews how good teamwork is in their world. And nearly 80% of the attending surgeons said teamwork is really good in my OR, which I think is awfully reassuring. I don't know if you feel the same way about your ORs or surgical suites. It's reassuring until you see what everyone else said. That's the anesthesiologist, the surgical nurses, the anesthesia nurses, and lowest on the totem pole, the anesthesia residents. This is known as an authority gradient, and the chance that the anesthesia resident or the anesthesia nurse is going to speak up to power when he or she suspects that something is wrong when there's this kind of a gradient is extraordinarily low. The interesting question in patient safety is not will they speak up when they're sure it's wrong, or would the co-pilot have spoken up if he was sure the Pan Am was in the way? Of course he would have. That's not interesting. What's interesting is will they speak up if they're not sure it's right? That will determine whether or not you're safe. And in this kind of an environment, with this kind of a gradient, the answer is they will not speak up. Brian also asked both surgeons and pilots, would you want someone to question you if they thought you were doing something wrong? Every pilot, of course, says, yes, are you kidding? Before I fly into a plane or a mountain, and half the surgeons, 10 years ago now, but I don't think it's changed very much, half the surgeons said no. Other point about safety culture I want to make is that we sometimes, in my world, we say, well, I know where they have a really good safety culture. They've got a really good culture at the Mayo Clinic or at the Cleveland Clinic or at Geisinger or you name it. And then the argument stops there because everyone that says, oh, yeah, but they're so different than us. Our patients are different. Everything's different. I actually think the most important lessons are not from another place. They're from your own organization. This is a study that Sexton did several years ago. He looked at safety culture in 100 different hospitals. This is the percent of people saying they had a good safety culture. And you see here's Hospital X with a lowish to medium safety culture. And you see there's some differences. 40% in this place had a good culture, 80% in this place. He then took Hospital X and looked at the safety culture in different units in Hospital X. So now each bar, one is the ER, another is labor and delivery, another is the ICU. And you see there's far more splay across within Hospital X than there is between hospitals. In other words, your hospital or your office doesn't really have a safety culture. Well, your office might. The hospital doesn't. It is one unit in the hospital has a very different one than the other. And I think that's a useful lesson because there are things we can learn really from our own environment. Somebody has figured this out. A couple other comments about culture before I come to a close. I want to move along just to be sure we have a little time. This is Gawande, Atul Gawande, the Harvard surgeon and writer. He wrote The Core Structure of Medicine, How Healthcare is Organized and Practiced, emerged in an era when doctors could hold all the key information patients needed in their heads and manage everything required themselves. We were craftsmen. We could set the fracture, spin the blood, plate the cultures, administer the antiserum. The nature of the knowledge lent itself to prizing autonomy, independence and self-sufficiency, and to designing medicine accordingly. That sounds like my training. I don't know about yours, but I was trained to be this sort of individual craftsman practicing the art of medicine. But Gawande went on in his New Yorker article and wrote, but you can't hold all the information in your head any longer, and you can't master all the skills. No one person can work up a patient's back pain, run the immunoassay, do the physical therapy, protocol the MRI, and direct the treatment of the unexpected cancer found growing in the spine. I don't even know what it means to protocol the MRI. That's the world that we inhabit today. The world is one that teamwork is not sort of a kind of elective kumbaya kind of thing. It's absolutely necessary to get this right. And yet these culture studies show that we're not very good at it. And we have to figure out ways of getting better at it if we're going to keep care safer. Spend just a moment on some of the challenges that I'm finding today, the health policy landscape, the demands on clinicians, and safety is only one concern in a value-driven world. I'll go through this quickly because I want to be sure we end on time. This is Gary Kaplan, I think arguably the most effective CEO, hospital CEO in the country. Gary wrote, the reduction in reimbursement and increasing consolidation threatens to make the focus on economic size and market competitiveness take precedence over getting better. This will be in part because the line of sight from senior leaders to the front lines will be more distant. It is a new problem that I'm certainly seeing in my place. We spend a lot of time talking about strategy and ACOs and who we should merge with, and less time than we did a few years ago talking about improvement. I think that's a real risk. We also talk about harmonization, yes, we're going to be measured in a lot of different ways, but at least come up with one set of measures so I don't have to kind of keep reviewing charts and reporting to 10 different agencies about the same thing. As my friend Mark Smith once said, everybody wants to be the harmonizer, but nobody wants to be the harmonizee. I can tell you that from my viewpoint as chair last year of the ABIM. We're part of the problem. We're producing new standards for doctors and trying to figure out how do we harmonize with the other things you're already being measured on, and yet we think our standards are better. It's a very tricky problem. Everybody in these organizations recognizes the issue, and yet we've not really gotten our acts together to agree on one set of standards. I think we will eventually, but we're not there yet. I won't go through this, just to say, here is patient safety. This is my own unit. And we recognize that patient safety is only one thing that we're working on when it comes to improvement. We're also working on quality improvement. We're also working on improving the patient's experience, partly because it's the right thing to do and partly because we're now being measured on it and being paid about it. We're also working on lean kinds of things, on cost and waste reduction. So safety is now hopefully synergistic with all these things, but really competing in a universe where we're trying to improve a lot of different things at the same time. And so here I've kind of put together the safety ecosystem, trying to summarize some of the things I've tried to highlight for you. The context is that there are a lot of pressures on us to improve safety and quality, whether it's accreditation, regulations, malpractice risk, social pressure, the media. The context is that healthcare is not straightforward. It's complicated. It's this complex adaptive system. There are parts of this that relate to systems thinking, learning from errors, having a reporting system, systems type solutions like standardization and checklists. There's part of this that relate to creating a safety culture, and obviously a very important part of this is having a safe workforce, well-trained, well-rested. All of that, I think, has to come together in order to provide safe care. The main with this is a story I heard from Don Berwick a couple years ago. With his permission, I share it. This is a part of Honduras that has terrible, terrible weather. Very frequent hurricanes, very frequent floods. And across this river, the Choluteca River, about 20 years ago, they said, we need to build a bridge, but we recognize the weather is really nasty here, and so we can't build any bridge. We have to build sort of the mother of all bridges. It's got to be terrific. They engaged the leading bridge design firm in the world, which happens to be in Japan, and they said, here's the problem, folks. The weather is terrible here. You need to build this amazing bridge. And this design firm in Japan took this charge very seriously. They put their best people on it, the best materials, the best computers, and they designed the Choluteca Bridge. And as they predicted, a couple of years after the bridge went up, along came Hurricane Mitch. It was a Category 5 hurricane, blew down houses everywhere, blew down all sorts of things, and the bridge stood. There was nearly a nick on this bridge. And I can imagine the folks in this bridge design firm in Japan giving each other high fives about what a spectacular job they had done. There was only one little problem, and that was that the river moved. I think in healthcare we have built this extraordinarily strong bridge, but it's over a river that doesn't exist anymore. I was talking to the medical students at my institution a few months ago, and I said to them, you are entering a world that's very different than the one I entered, and in some ways I feel sorry for you. It's a lot of pressure. You are going to have to figure out a way to deliver the highest quality, safest, most satisfying care at the lowest cost. And they looked at me in that kind of naive way that smart but novices tend to be. They looked at me, one of them raised their hands, and they said, what exactly were you trying to do? And I said, that's actually right. It's perfectly sensible. We are now in a world where we're being pressured to figure out how do we deliver the best care at a cost that will not bankrupt our society. And I think a big part of it is thinking about safety and quality in a way that's different than we ever have before. Thank you so much for your attention. I really appreciate it. Thank you.